You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Tuesday, April 7th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, folks, it's one of our famous vacation shows, wherein we go on vacation, but we take no vacation from giving you brand new content. Why? Just not very good at business. I don't know. I guess, I mean, it's not unreasonable that we would take a vacation and not put up new shows, but it's not what we're doing. As you can see, last week when I recorded this, I still had a cold. Today, I don't know. I'm hanging out with the kids. They probably got me sick again. So, I can't really attest to how well my vacation's going, frankly. And really, in the end, it doesn't matter, because if I hadn't told you I was on vacation, yes, a percentage of you would know because you listen to the show live, but a huge percentage of you.
Michael doesn't even know you're on vacation.
Michael doesn't realize I'm on vacation. Michael's not even really aware that we're not broadcasting live. That's how engaged he is in the show. And we could say that because he already skipped out. So this is what you get, buddy.
We should leave breadcrumbs in every one of these intros for him.
Exactly. So, folks, we got a great show for you today. Gerald Posner, who's written a book called God's Bankers, is on the program today. It's about the Vatican. And it was fascinating. The whole thing is fascinating to me. And I'm not Catholic. I'm not terribly interested in the Vatican. But its role as a banker over the years is quite fascinating. And Posner's has done a tremendous amount of research and has written an amazing book. And for members today, we just have, what is it? It's a couple minutes.
It's like,
right?
A few minutes, maybe like three,
yeah.
4 minutes.
We ended up having a conversation after the interview, and we've tacked that on. In the coming days for members, we have some amazing material. Really interesting.
Yeah, some archive stuff. That
deep archive.
Yeah.
Deep archive for the next 3 days,
yeah,
after that.
One that's not available if, you know, you just go to the website and search.
We're talking
Air America archives.
No,
these
stuff. Are deep archives.
Yeah.
These are from like 2004, 2005. Only available to members under any circumstance. So enjoy today's interview with Gerald Posner. Coming up this week, we got Ryan Cooper on how your local jail became hell. Joan Fitzgerald talking about urban policy and public affairs, specifically around water. Adam Green from the PCCC. We've got Keith Whalew, a professor of history from Princeton, on a book he's written about pain and the political history of pain. For members, Jose Rivera, who wrote and directed the Motorcycle Diaries. We've got Colin Quinn. We got Patton Oswalt from the back in the day. Aaron Magruder, the guy who drew the Boondocks. That interview is really fascinating, actually, because he speaks about, this is back in 2004, and he speaks about, you know, waiting for a new crop of black leadership. And a lot of people have been talking about the Black Lives Matter movement that has come out of Ferguson as having those people. All right. So enjoy Gerald Posner, and tune in tomorrow. We will have a new show for you. We are back on the Majority Report. On the phone, it is a pleasure to welcome to the program Gerald Posner, best-selling author of nearly a dozen books, I guess, and author of the latest God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. Welcome to the program, Gerald.
I'm great to be with you.
So the book is fascinating, and I don't know much about the Vatican, I have to say, and I feel like I know more, and it almost in some ways raises more questions for me, quite frankly. But leaving aside those larger questions, at least for the moment anyways, give us a sense. Your book really focuses, and the birth of, I guess, the Vatican Bank takes place during World War II. But before we get to that, give us a sense of the role money plays with the Vatican, starting basically in the Middle Ages, and how money and the Vatican mixed.
Sam, perfect. It's a great question. You know, a lot of people just want to focus just on modern Vatican, but if you miss what you just said, that Middle Age relationship with money, then it's hard to understand how they get so messed up later on. In the Middle Ages, it was easy for them, relatively. They were Pope kings. So instead of just running the biggest religion on earth, which they did, and packaging as the one and only true faith, they were also their own empire. They had like 15,000 square miles of central Italy. They were kings, just the same royal power as the British kings, the French, the Spanish. They levied taxes, collected fees, all the things that monarchs did back then, and it fed the empire. And even then, they had trouble staying afloat because they had such a large papal court. It rivaled that in Europe, 700 servants at its height. They were always running short of money. Twice they had to borrow money in the 1700s into the 1800s from the Rothschilds, which drove the old traditionalists, the real hardline Catholic cardinals, crazy that they were having to go to what they viewed as, you know, the Jewish Christ killers, as they would call them, to borrow money. But that's where the Vatican had come. And then what turned out to be the game changer for them was 1870. They lost their empire. Italy became unified. The nationalists threw them out, and they were reduced to this little, like, postage stamp piece of property called Vatican City, and they were just now head of the church. That was it. No sovereign entity. They got the sovereignty back in 1929 from, of all people, Benito Mussolini, the fascist dictator of Italy, who hits a deal with them. The church acknowledges him as the rightful ruler of Italy, and he acknowledges them as the one and true church. It's a love made in central casting, and that with that sovereignty, they go back to being a country again and a religion, and that's, you know, sort of the modern Vatican beginning.
And we should say, too, that there's a certain amount of irony in the Vatican having to go to the Rothschilds for loans, because in some way it's Vatican edicts that grow the sort of Jewish mercantile, Jewish banking industry.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, it's so interesting because it's institutionalized anti-Semitism established by Catholicism across centuries in Europe. In many ways, you know, by the time you get to World War II and the Nazis have put that anti-Semitism into a form of mass extermination, they're reaping the what would be coming out of the church's basis for having created this war on Jews for years, and that was a bloody war times in the Inquisition. But Jews inside of ghettos, that Rome was the oldest ghetto inside of all of Europe, could not participate in the guilds and couldn't be in many industries or businesses. They were limited to things that the church deemed unsavory, like money lending. The church thought that their Roman Catholic Church said there was a ban against loaning money at interest. It was usury. They disdained capitalism in the beginning of capitalism because it was modernism, it was free thinking. They knew that was dangerous. They intuitively knew that that was dangerous to a monarchy, that if people started to think independently, they might challenge, hey, who's this guy on the throne telling us what to do, or in the papacy. And it's interesting that they viewed very much early capitalism as the province of Jews and heretical Protestants, and wanted nothing to do with it. So when they finally had to embrace capitalism in the late 19th century and the 20th century, it's so ironic that here's this, the church that had created sort of this anti-capitalist view, and once they came into embracing it, they embraced it on steroids.
And just to sort of like also get a sense of what was happening, once they are limited, I guess, in terms of their empire is really no more. They still have, they don't have the sort of the same, I guess, geographic control, but they have this almost like psychographic control insofar as they're still collecting taxes on Catholics in some way or explicitly.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Control is a perfect way to view it and explain it. They had, under Bismarck, here is the church without having any sovereign power. And under Bismarck in the early 1900s, they strike a deal, late 1800s, with the head of Germany at the time to say, we would like to collect a tax of 8 to 10%, very little depending upon which part of Germany, on everybody who's a Catholic in the country. So if you say, I'm a Catholic, and you earn $20,000 a year, you're going to pay, if 10%, $2,000 to the Catholic Church. Bismarck strikes that deal with them and says to the church, it has to be voluntary. You go ahead and collect it. Well, that meant, you know, they were on the honor system. At that time, they collected a fair amount of money, but it was an unusual thing that people actually not just made donations, but paid a tax. Now comes 1933. The Vatican is a country again. They're a sovereign nation, according to Mussolini, and the rest of the world who all acknowledge them as that. And they are the first country to strike an accord with Hitler. He's just come to power as chancellor, the first nation to recognize him officially as the Vatican. It gives him some standing. And as part of the deal that they strike with Hitler, the Third Reich agrees to collect the tax on German Catholics at its source, like a payroll tax. So when your check is issued to you from Volkswagen or from Mercedes or from AG Telefunken, the amount as a Catholic that you would pay to the church is taken out, and Hitler sends it on to the Catholic Church. It means that the amount of money the Catholics were receiving as a result of that tax, the Vatican went up dramatically. In 1943, one of the few years in which the documents have survived to show what they got, they were getting about $100 million a year, big money back then in terms of that tax just from the German tax. So it created a dependence and reliance on the Third Reich and on some of those countries in which the taxes were collected.
Yeah, that element I find just stunning. So you have prior to that, right? It is priests. It's direct agents of the Vatican who are collecting this tax in the form of, I guess, tithing. But right. Then it moves into something that's more institutional. Is this? Like, I mean, are there other examples? I wonder, is this the only place where they had this arrangement where the government functions as their tax collector, A, and B, a subsidiary question, is there a kickback?
The Germans did say yes. There is a kickback. It's fabulous. Of course, you know that no government will do anything just for free. So the Germans did, in fact, collect a commission based upon doing it that was running about 2% of what was being collected. So if $100 million was going in, they were pocketing $2 million just for sending it on. And the Nazis, by the way, did not just do it for the Catholics. I was also startled by this because I just didn't know about it when I started the research. They also collected it on behalf of the Protestants. So 95% of all Germans paid a church tax during the years that Hitler was in power, even though Hitler was anti-church in all his rhetoric. And most of the Nazis, although Catholics, were anti-church. That concept of the tax, not surprisingly, Sam, because it's so successful in raising money, has spread and today covers, if I remember correctly, it's Germany, Sweden, Denmark, Austria, Finland, Switzerland, Iceland, and most of Italy. And one of my favorite cases was a case in which a German sued and said, I don't want to pay the tax, I'm not a practicing Catholic, but I'd like to be buried Catholic. And the church went to a German court and said, no, he can't be buried Catholic unless he pays the tax. And the court said, yep, you've got to pay it. The German press dubbed that, I think, pay to pray. So,
and I guess, and what's also, I guess, a little bit chilling about this is that you enter into Hitler's regime enters into the Holocaust with a pretty good sense of who is a Protestant, who is a Catholic, and who is not, presumably who is then a Jew at that point.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting because I, as you know, I play out in this book the what I call the series of laws that are passed by the Third Reich to institutionalize the process of excluding Jews, excluding Jews from society, and then eventually stripping them of their assets and stealing everything from them, and then on top of that, eventually leading to mass murder, and the process of which the Vatican does not make protestations along the way. But there is one key part at which the Vatican becomes key, the Catholic Church does, in helping Hitler realize exactly who's Jewish and who's not. And this cuts back really into this period in 1933 when the first laws come in. There's what I call a historian has called it an anti-Semitic attestation bureaucracy, and what he's referring to is the surrendering by Catholic priests of their parishes, marriage, and baptism records. The Nazis used those records to verify blood purity because they defined Judaism by blood. As a result, by the time the Nazis had enacted their law for genetically diseased offspring, as they called it, institutionalized sterilization, they had all of those baptism and marriage records. They were able to find out exactly who was Catholic and who wasn't.
And so then, and it's interesting because, you know, I guess there's a presumption. I mean, I don't feel this as much. I'm not a Catholic. So my expectations of what the Vatican does are not not necessarily shaped by that. To me, they're an institution, not unlike any other institution. But there is a period where it appears or there seems, I mean, and you talk about there was an opportunity which was lost with Pope Pius, I guess, the 11th, if I'm not mistaken, right. Who was to issue an encyclical. Tell us about that, and then what happens when he passes and Pius the 12th enters the scene.
Right. So the Pope before World War II dies actually on 1939, right on the eve of World War II, right before the Germans invade Poland and start the hot war, such as it is, had been a long tenure as a Pope, a pretty strong anti-Semite, sort of steeped in the tradition of anti-Semitism, had struck the deal both with Mussolini and with Hitler. But near the end of his papacy, starting about 35, 36, 3 to 4 years before it ends, he starts to feel regrets. He thinks the Germans are reneging on it. They're criticizing the church too much. He doesn't like the anti-Semitism that he thinks has gone too far. It's even beyond the pale for him. And he gets an American Jesuit and a few other liberal priests to put together an encyclical. Would be a decree from him that carries the official weight of a monarch. Everybody has to follow it. It's his opinion, and it's to comment and condemn anti-Semitism, which would be, from the Pope, an extraordinary statement, although it might not seem much to, you know, your listeners who will say, well, isn't it normal just to condemn anti-Semitism? But the popes had not done that, and it festered in the liturgy. They were still talking about perfidious Jews. A lot of the priests were still preaching in Eastern Europe the idea that there was blood libel, that the Jews were, in fact, killing Christian babies for blood use on Passover. It's a terrible history. So the idea that the Pope could issue a clear sort of declaration against it was a great thing. That sat around for a long time. It was being transferred around. It got transferred to traditionalists and conservatives who sort of slowed the process up. They didn't want to get it out. The Pope dies just on the eve of its completion, but before he can get it out, the next Pope, who was the Secretary of State and had been the ambassador to Germany and loves everything German, turns out to be the Pope for the war, takes that encyclical and puts it, as I've seen, in the secret archives. It never comes out, and it's not even known that it's not even public for the next 20 years until it's finally broken in a story in the press. So there was a lost opportunity that if that had come out before the war, maybe it would have had an impact on Catholics, especially since Catholics were the overwhelming perpetrators in the execution of the concentration camps. They were the Nazis who were there in overwhelming numbers, also happened to be Catholics.
And it also, I guess, would have had impact on the clergy who are on the ground in Germany and Poland and throughout where, basically on the ground, beginning to see, essentially, the Holocaust happened in real time. I mean, this is what I also found fascinating, had never occurred to me, but you make it clear that the Vatican knew what was going on. And we have reports, of course, of the Allies also knowing what was going on. But
right.
But in some ways, the Vatican had the greatest network of, yeah, I guess, intelligence network. And that would have theoretically impacted those clergy people if that encyclical had been issued.
That's absolutely right. I think, Sam, that's completely correct. As a matter of fact, the Vatican had an unusual position here to have influenced what was going to happen, not knowing what was going to take place, but what did in fact happen. Not only because the Catholics were heavy on the ground in the administration eventually, what would be the concentration camps, but for instance, in Czechoslovakia, Priest had founded the principal political party. It was a strong anti-Semitic Slovak People's Party, but the prime minister and the president were both, in fact, Catholics. A Catholic priest was running Croatia. Catholic priests were all around there, and a daily communicant, daily mass worshiper in Croatia. So they did have the ability to have some effect. But more than that, what you said a moment ago, I think, is critical. The Allies did have information, the British and Americans eventually, about this enormous civilian slaughter in the East. And they have nothing but to hang their heads in shame because they did essentially nothing. But the Vatican had information earlier, by about 18 months, better information than anybody else, in part because of those priests you mentioned. They had thousands of parishes all over Eastern Europe in the killing zones, and the priests in those local parishes would hear back reports about what was happening. They would see the trains packed with people heading to the camps. They would hear the stories. They would hear about the Einsatzgruppen and the mobile killing squads in the beginning in Russia and in Poland. And they would report that to the bishops. The bishops would send it in diplomatic pouches every day they arrived at the Vatican in the Secretary of State's office. And one of the people in the Secretary of State's office, Montini, then a Monsignor, met almost daily with the Pope. He was a hands-on administrator of the Pope. So that information started to filter in early on. Church had better information than anybody else and still didn't act.
And we should say, again, that's Pius the 12th. And before we get to the sort of the next step and why that level of awareness is important to note because of, it informs some of the reasons why, or if not, some of the primary reasons why the Vatican established a bank. But is it your sense that the Pius XII was chosen? Was it a coincidence that he was Germanophile? What, I'm not sure what the word is. But
right.
I mean, is it a coincidence or was it or not? I guess.
It's a great question. Trying to divine how that vote split, because people think that they just go in a group of cardinals and select the next pope based upon who they like. But it's they're throwing elbows. It's dirty down politics, just like Republicans and Democrats going for each other's throat. They form cliques. They like each other. There's some traditionalists, some are reformists. I think that the reason it broke for Pius the 12th favor at that election, and he was elected pope in one of the fastest votes in well over 100 years, 300 years, was because he was viewed as the diplomat of the group. He had been the Secretary of State. He had gone back and forth. He had good relations in Germany. And since the world was at the edge of war, it was all so tense, they said, let's go with the guy who understands international diplomacy because he'll be able to keep the ship safe in the middle of these stormy wars. It turned out that his way of keeping it safe was to make sure that it never brought its head up to get whacked by taking any controversial position. He put, and not surprisingly, I understand that as the Pope, his position is to protect the Catholic Church, but he also does have, and you mentioned this before, you're not Catholic, so you look at it as an institution. So does it have an extra moral responsibility? Well, everyone shares that moral responsibility to have acted against mass murder. But if you're also selling yourself as the one true church and saying that you as Pope have an infallible connection to God on issues of faith, which is one of the doctrines of the church, and you collect money and contributions based upon people who believe in the religion sending it to you to support you, then I think maybe you do have some enhanced, to the extent it exists, moral responsibility to act. But he certainly was not going to risk any part of the church for taking on the responsibility of saving others.
And so it is during that time that a bank is established. In part, you write, the motivation there is to basically ensure that they have control over the information of who they're getting money from and who they're loaning money to.
Yeah, that's the most, to me, the most interesting part of the Vatican Bank almost is its formation, that you look at the date and you know something's wrong. It's June 1942. It's right in the middle of the war, 3 years in, 3 years before it ends. The reason is the Vatican was named a sovereign country again by Mussolini in 1929. Mussolini also gave them the equivalent of $1 billion in 2014 money to make up for the loss of the papal states. The clerics who ran the church, including Pius XI back then, were smart enough to know they didn't know how to invest that money. So they went out and they hired a wizard, a layman, Bernardino Nogaro, who was great at managing the money. He's the one who said to the Pope, Pius XII, in the middle of the war, we need our own bank, something like a central bank as a country would have, but it doesn't make loans, it doesn't have to turn a profit, there's only one shareholder, the Pope, and that bank was used by Nogaro to bring the Vatican black, and what I mean by that is off the radar, so the Americans and British who were tracking it, trying to find if they were doing business with the Nazis and the Italian fascists, could no longer follow the money, and they successfully did that. Through the war, they were able to do business with both sides, Americans, British, Nazis, Italians, and even to this day, questions remain about the extent to which they profited from everyone.
What does the business look like, though? I mean, that's what I am still sort of like a little bit hazy on. Like, what are they doing as a bank? It's, you know, I mean, prior to this, obviously, they are. I mean, are they having to go through Italian banks, say, to get their the tax money from the Nazis? And
That's right. Before that, they were having to do that. They were having to go through correspondent banks. After that, they didn't have to. There was only one branch. It was in Vatican City. It could be transferred. In fact, they could have the tax money transferred to a Swiss bank, who would then transfer it to a Liechtenstein bank, who would then transfer it over to the Vatican Bank. By the time it went through the second bounce, it was tough to follow. By the time it got to the Vatican Bank, it just went into a black hole. How do they do their investments? It varied. In the U.S., they bought stocks. They bought, through the House of Morgan, open positions in public companies. They transferred physical gold here. They transferred physical gold, some of it, to the U.K. as well. They bought real estate in London that they have to this day, some of the most prominent West End real estate, which was a great early investment. They did their investment with the Germans mostly through Italian proxies, these Italian businessmen who would sit in for them on a board, and they would hold an equity interest primarily in insurance companies that operated in Eastern Europe earning outsized profits. And they also invested in Italian companies in direct positions. So, for instance, they bought a stake in Generali, Italy's biggest insurance company. That was a blacklisted company by the U.S. and the British, but they didn't know, they couldn't find the Vatican stake at that time. They bought Fondiaria, the fourth largest insurance company, a controlling interest in the war 6 weeks after its Jewish directors had been purged by new anti-Semitic race laws. So those laws that knocked Jews off the directorship of Fondiaria didn't stop the Vatican from investing Vatican Bank money into that business. So it's a whole series of little things that you track and can put together.
Now, how do we know that information? If presumably, I know the answer is your research, but I'm curious as to how, like, where that is recorded. Because if presumably they become a bank, so they don't have to go through a third party to make these investments, and so that there is no third party who can get together and say, hey, these guys, the Vatican's investing here and they're investing there. I mean, why become a bank as opposed to just like we have a treasury?
Well, you know, you're absolutely right, because the I think that what Nagar was smart enough is it's not just a central bank. It's a bit like a Wall Street investment bank. They use it for investments aggressively as well. And, I mean, the real reason, why does the Vatican say it formed the bank? The Vatican says it formed it because it was looking for the ability to have religious orders and charities and priests put money into the Vatican Bank as opposed to having to worry about the instability of a bank in a war-torn country. But what the Vatican Bank did from the very first day it was created is it told Italians and nervous Europeans, but primarily Italians who had a lot of money and were nervous about what was happening in the war, to move their money into the safety of Vatican City. All they had to do was cross the street into Vatican City, get a Monsignor or a Cardinal that was friendly with them, and deposit physically truckloads of cash. They felt it was safer there. So from the very beginning, it became sort of what I call a source of scared or nervous flight money. And when you say, how do we know a lot of the things, each instance is different, but a perfect case is Fondiaria. For instance, in that case, the company that was the fourth largest insurer that was bought by the Vatican 6 weeks after the Jewish directors were knocked off, that was found in a what's called a safe haven report compiled by American intelligence after World War II. It's in the National Archives. The Americans didn't even know that there was any link at all to Fondiaria until they arrested its president in the big sweep of Axis power collaborators after the war, and he told them the story. Then they were able to recreate it. That often happened. It's the third parties that released the information. So the information about the Vatican investments in Generali came mostly from Allianz, Generali's partner, to the extent the Allianz documents had survived. It's information about the gold movements came from material the Treasury Department was able to find after the war. So a lot of it was pieced together by post-war investigators from third parties or the recipients of the Vatican's profiteering.
And so would they take this money? I'm an Italian businessman, and I develop a relationship with a member of the clergy in Vatican City, and under that that person's name, I deposit X million dollars worth of, or $1 million, let's say. Does the Vatican then use that money in their investments? I mean, is that how they benefit from these deposits?
No, that's interesting. They don't. So they never take that money and use it. They don't commingle it at all. And here's why they accept it. So then you think, well, why did you even take it? For a while, they were taking a commission that at one point had gone up. I think I have it marked as high as 8%. That's very high, but it was
fees.
Cheaper.
That sounds familiar to me.
Right. You know, a little bit of a fee, but cheaper for an Italian who's looking at paying a 30% tax, let's say, on capital gains or that, to avoid the tax, put it there and pay the Vatican that. In some cases, they were taking a much smaller percentage, 1 or 2%, for handling the money, for nothing more than depositing it. And in other instances, I believe, I can't prove this with absolute certainty unless I'm able to get into their files, which they've blocked me from, I think they took no fee. And those were instances in which the CIA passed money through after the war to be used for political purposes to defeat the communists in the first post-war election, in which Ronald Reagan's CIA, then years later in the late 70s and early 80s, or in the early 80s, passed money through for the Polish Pope to fight the communism in the Iron Curtain. And also, I think they took no fee when they took these slush funds for Italian politicians. So there's one case in which, sort of the best case or the worst case, if you want to say, Giulio Andreotti, who is, I guess, Italy's most powerful post-war politician. He's 7 times prime minister. He died a year ago. It turns out he had a fund inside the Vatican Bank called the Cardinal Spellman Foundation. It existed, Sam, nowhere else in the world. There was no such thing. It only exists in the Vatican Bank. He used it over the years with the help of a Monsignor, who was his sort of front guy, to pass $60 million through, and some of it used to pay his wife's jeweler, some used out to dole political favors, some used as what appear to be bribes but have never been proven as bribes. So I think on that, the Vatican didn't collect a fee because they liked the idea that they were in an alliance with the politicians on this dirty money, which meant the politicians had to therefore do things in the service of the Italian government that benefited
right.
The church, because the church knew some dirty secrets.
You're talking about services in kind to powerful people. I mean, my understanding is that Andreotti was there's a lot of reason to suspect that he was involved in the mafia.
Right, and you know, and this those rumors, and I don't know them, have always been around about Andreotti, but they're also around. And you know, I talk about this about in the Vatican Bank, the person who was the biggest business partner in the 70s, and that with the Vatican Bank was an Italian businessman, Nicola Sindona,
right,
who ended up dead right from cyanide poisoning in a jail cell in the Italian scene.
Tell that story, because that's amazing how when you see any of these movies about the mafia and you see the fear involved with people who are going to turns evidence against the mafia, and they insist they'll always get to me. The Sedona seems like the archetype of that case.
Yeah, you know, I think that it is, and the reason is here you have a guy, Sindona, who's one of Italy's most prominent financiers. He had bought Franklin National, the bank in the U.S. It was at the time it went bankrupt here in a big bankruptcy fraud, the largest bankruptcy then in U.S. history, like $2 billion. And he eventually gets convicted for having killed one of the prosecutors who was investigating him. He's deep in with the Vatican Bank, and he personally knows the Pope. He has dinner with the Pope. And when he gets sentenced to this life sentence in Italy, the 2 days after the sentence, this is my favorite part, they have built a special constructed sort of high-security prison wing for him. It's like a one-person prison-like wing. And he has a cell with a single cell inside that section. His food is being checked when it's prepared down the hallway by a small group that's watching over it. It's brought to him in sealed containers so that nothing can happen to it when they bring it back to him. And, you know, 2 days after they bring it into him, and he has a sip of espresso, and he starts stumbling around the cell from the bathroom saying, I've been poisoned, grabbing at his throat. It's like straight out of a movie. His Godfather 3 couldn't do it better, and he turns out dead from cyanide. And they look at it and say, he must have been hiding the cyanide somewhere in his mouth or in the jail cell. We couldn't find it. Suicide. And that was the end of the investigation.
Yeah, that's a very strange way to react to your own suicide, is to say that I've been poisoned.
It is indeed. You would think that it's unusual to, you know, as you're killing yourself. Hermann Göring, one of the big Nazi leaders, who did in fact, you know, get a cyanide capsule before the Americans were able to hang him, and so he, committed suicide inside the jail at Nuremberg. Didn't rush up to the cell when he, you know, broke the capsule saying, I've been poisoned. He, you know, broke the capsule and died. That's what he wanted to do. It was a way of exiting it. So it was a little unusual, to say the least. There were a lot of people inside of Italy, in the power circles, inside companies, and inside the Vatican Bank, who may have had nothing to do with Sindona's death, but who breathed a sigh of relief when he died, because he knew a lot of tales that nobody wanted out.
Talk to us, too, about Paul Marcinkus, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Yeah, because no, you are.
This is an era where the Pope at the time really has a very close relationship, it seems to me, from what you're explaining, with the Reagan administration, and is actively involved in a lot of stuff that the Reagan administration was up to.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because Marcinkus is this American monsignor at first, and then he becomes a bishop. He's from Cicero, Illinois, but he goes over to the Vatican in the 60s, and he's a 6'3" a gregarious, outgoing American, which a lot of the Italians over in the Vatican found very irritating, but he was likable enough, and people did like him, and the Pope took a liking to him. The earlier Pope, John Paul XXIII, in the early 60s, sort of used him as a front and logistics man and as an interpreter. And then the next Pope, Paul VI, took a liking to him and appointed him to eventually go over to the Vatican Bank, and soon he became the head of the Vatican Bank. And you know, you'd think, Sam, okay, so what's your financial background? And the answer would be none. There was none. He didn't know a thing. He admitted that later. He bought some books and tried to study up, but they thought he had a take-hold, charge attitude, and he would be good running it. That's how they end up in trouble half the time. And Marcinkus is in way over his head. He gets involved with guys like Sindona and another guy, Calvi, who's a banker, who ends up opening the book dead under a London bridge, hanging. They think that's a suicide until they determine it's a murder decades later. And Marcinkus gets involved in some of these early scandals. It looks like his time is running out. The Pope's going to kick him out. But his life and career is saved by the Polish Pope, who becomes Pope in 78, and that's because of what you said. they have a camaraderie together. The Polish Pope takes to the Lithuanian background of Marcinkus. They both feel like outsiders in an otherwise Italian institution. And when John Paul II decides he wants to be a cold warrior against communism, Marcinkus is there with him. He helps funnel the money in. He runs the money for the CIA. The Americans like the fact that he's an American, and he becomes an informant for the State Department, as I disclose in the book for the first time, sort of giving them information about what's happening inside the Vatican and helping to move the Pope's political positions to be more like what the Americans want. So it was a real alliance here between them, and he survived as head of the bank until the late 80s when the Italians indicted him, and two of his top aides, the Vatican wouldn't let him out of Vatican City. It was a big legal standoff, and eventually the Italian High Court held Vatican sovereignty trumps all. Marcinkus can't be extradited, and he never spent a day in an Italian courtroom.
And so let's move up to just the notion of reform here. Now, I know that you're involved in petitioning to get a lot of the documents during the World War II released, and there seems to be Pope Francis seems to have at least some interest in reforming this operation, and you argue that part of that is a function of the introduction of the euro. Bring us through, I guess, from over the past 15 years or so.
You're right. So what happened is in 99, nobody took any attention. When this happened, nobody thought it had an effect on the Vatican because it didn't look like it did. And what I'm talking about is Italy's decision to do what most European countries were doing, except for a handful, and that was decide they were going to go with the common currency that was being rolled out, the euro. So they give up the lira, go with the euro. That put the Vatican in a bind because the Vatican relied on the lira as its own currency, one of the reasons why it was so incestuous between Italy and the Vatican for money laundering and sharing funds and all of that. They had the same currency. So they talked about issuing their own currency. They decided against it. They said, let's go with the euro. What very few of them realized at that time was that by doing that, they were opening themselves up to mandatory inspections by financial evaluators sent from Brussels. The EU would want to see their central bank was compliant in terms of having rules in effect to stop terrorism financing, money laundering. The Vatican had none of that. Sam, they didn't have a law against money laundering until 2011 when they were sort of shoved into doing it. They didn't have a law against stopping financing for terrorism in terms of cash until 2011. They didn't have any limit on the amount of cash you could bring in. Now it's 10,000 euros. So
that's I got to say, that sounds like not a bug, but a feature. I mean, it sounds like they were developed to escape those laws. Like that was their value add as a bank.
I love the way you just said that. It's not a bug, but a feature. You're absolutely right. That's how I really do view. Some people think that I'm too hard when I say this was operated as for most of its history as an offshore bank in the heart of Rome. And that's really what it was, just like any bank in the Caymans or wherever else. It was a feature, and that was one of the benefits that made it a successful, you know, outlier in terms of international banks. But it comes back to your question about Francis as a reformer. He is pushing ahead reforms. He has hired some good independent financial people from the outside who aren't priests. They are all Catholic, but they aren't priests. And I think he's doing the right thing, but I also think he doesn't have much choice. Any pope in this position, even if they drag their feet a little bit, would have to meet the new rules set down by Brussels, or they're going to lose their status and their ability to use the euro. So the financial reforms that are taking place will, over time, make this a fairly compliant and boring mid-level international bank. Maybe the worst of the days will be over, but it won't be because the Vatican took the lead in doing it.
Do you have any sense as to any role that they had in, I guess it was in 2008, maybe 2009, U.S. government made a deal with a lot of Swiss banks that said basically, okay, the game is over. We have the list of people who've been hiding, avoiding taxes by putting banks here. That's over now. I mean, do you have a sense of, to the extent that was the Vatican ever played that type of role as well? I mean, outside of,
never.
It sounds like they clearly played it in Italy. I wonder if it was also international.
It played to a much smaller extent internationally. I think that the international clients that were there would be a handful because of the fact, although Marvin Franco had been a large in the 90s fraud case here in the U.S. as a financier, ended up having an account at the Vatican Bank through a Monsignor that he knew. There are those instances, but the Italians were the ones that really used the bank as their own personal offshore bank, and part of the reason for that is it's the same thing that went back to World War II. In World War II, the Vatican declared it was neutral. Morgenthau, Secretary of the Treasury, and his Treasury Department, who were issuing the blacklist, had a real heated debate inside. Is it neutral or not? They put on the blacklist, the Treasury did, San Marino, Liechtenstein, Monaco, all these little countries that were technically neutral, but they didn't think were really operating as neutral. The only country that stayed on the neutral list was the Vatican. They finally decided, oh, they're priests. They're religious. They can stay neutral. That was impossible because they were Italian. And I'm half Italian. I can say this. They were 98% Italian in the Curia at that time, the bureaucracy. Their brothers were on the other side of the wall fighting for the Italian military. Their brothers were on the other side of the wall as titans of Italian industry. They were intertwined with the interests of Italy. And that's the same thing that's kept the bank serving it to Italy and its uber-rich and the mob over the years, is that you'll have a priest who's in there at a senior position inside the Vatican Bank, and he comes from a family of three sisters and five brothers, and one of them's a maid member of the mafia down in Calabria, and another one happens to be running a bank in Milan. There's this nature in which it comes back and forth. It's the same problem we've seen in Italy since the end of the war, 71 coalition governments and one corruption scandal after another. We shouldn't think that it should be necessarily that different inside Vatican City just because they have a religious hat on as well.
Well, I got to say, the whole story of this, I just find so, it is just so, there's such a cognitive dissonance, because in some level, like, you know, if you're talking about HSBC, I would say, yeah, of course. I mean, these guys, but then there's this other thing. It's like, this is actually supposed to be the center of a religion. And that is what is so, sort of stunning about your book. It's God's Bankers, A History of Money and Power at the Vatican. Gerald Posner, thank you so much for your time today and talking about it. We will put a link to it at our site at Majority FM.
Thanks, Sam, so much for having me on. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you.